England and eastern Scotland. Cool and cloudy here, and wet and windy for many too. Again, there'll be some snow on the hills first thing. There'll be some dry spells in the morning across eastern Scotland, but it will turn wet here later on, perhaps drying up across the Midlands and parts of northern England later on. Temperatures struggling for most of the day, perhaps peaking at 12 Celsius. That's the forecast.
Alex, thank you. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week. And matters of political reform loom large during the reign of William IV. Tension is in the air as we meet the main characters behind it all, Grey, Wellington and other Whigs and Tories. In Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser.
The opening of Parliament on the 2nd of November 1830 was preceded by discussions which centred on the reforming proposals of the new MP for Yorkshire, Henry Brougham. In his 50s, his rise to prominence had been a result of his own efforts. Irascible, multifaceted, Brougham was dazzling in his oratory, as a result of which he had earned an enormous living at the bar, strictly necessary for his lavish way of life. Lord Holland paid an extraordinary tribute to him. His style of oratory, he wrote in his diary, was almost preternatural and miraculous, based on the variety and versatility of his genius. Such a character lent itself to caricature, and his extraordinary bottle nose helped, as did the piercing eyes under projecting brows and the uproarious condition of his dark grey hair. But even without such an eccentric appearance, Brougham would have made his mark. For one thing, his self-confidence was boundless. One exchange with Lord Grey seemed to sum him up. The two great men were crossing a ford at Howick, which turned out to be flooded. Grey asked Brougham, "Can you swim?" To which Brougham replied magnificently, "I've never swum, but I have no doubt I could if I tried." In their rising anxieties for reform in principle, the Whig notables were not necessarily inclined to favour Brougham's reforms. The Whigs were, like a body of men with an enormous dog of famous attacking power at their side. Admire the dog as they might, they were never sure where the dog would place his huge jaws next. The opening of the new Parliament therefore found all those concerned apprehensive. If many of the Tories were surly, the Whigs, like all people who had been out of office for a long time, did not necessarily believe their moment had come. Grey's political leadership was untried. Meanwhile, ferment in the country was spreading. One of those following this turbulent scene with acute interest was the radical tailor Francis Place. Here was a man who thoroughly understood the life of the poor. His father being bailiff at the Marshalsea Court, he was actually raised in a debtor's prison. Reform for him had become a primary element of justice for the working classes. And he issued a prophecy. No corrupt system ever yet reformed itself. King William IV arrived at Parliament with a clear-cut duty to perform, declaring the government's policy for the coming session. But the King's speech made no reference to parliamentary reform. Lord Grey's speech drew attention to what had been left unsaid. There had been no discussion of the violence which now dominated the domestic scene. "If danger is all around us, the way to go is by securing the affections of your fellow subjects and by redeeming their grievances. And, my lords, I will pronounce the word by reforming Parliament." The Duke of Wellington rose to his feet shortly after. He was not only not prepared to bring forward any measure of this nature, but he would at once declare that as far as he was concerned, he would always feel it his duty to resist such measures when proposed by others. At first, the Lords sat in silence. Then the murmuring began, as the implications of the Prime Minister's message began to sink in. Did the Iron Duke have some inkling of the stark and starkly confrontational nature of what he'd just said? "I have not said too much, have I?" he asked the Foreign Secretary, Lord Aberdeen, at his side. "You'll hear of it," replied Aberdeen. Everyone could soon hear the noise of outraged reaction to the Duke's speech. The fires, the hooliganism, the unpredictable behaviour of mobs, especially in London, alarmed not only the government, but also the royal establishment. The King and Queen were destined by immemorial custom to attend the Lord Mayor's banquet on the 9th of November. Under the circumstances, the government advised the King not to attend. By the 7th of November, the theatres were closed for very fear. The jewellers and silversmiths shut up shop and sent their goods to the banks, while the merchants barricaded their warehouses. In the meantime, the Birmingham Political Union, under Thomas Attwood's leadership, petitioned the King to dismiss his ministers. Wellington remained characteristically calm, telling the Knight of Kerry crisply on the 6th of November that he did not have the leisure to discuss parliamentary reform. At the same time, strict precautions were taken at his splendid London residence, Apsley House, with its many windows facing Hyde Park. Armed men were stationed at the more vulnerable windows, such as the Duchess's bathroom and the Duke's bedroom. The Whig motion, agreed on the 13th of November, took into consideration the state of representation of the people in Parliament with a view to remedy such defects as may appear therein. 2 days later, in a vote in the House of Commons on this mild motion, the government were defeated. Young Lord Durham, Grey's handsome and impetuous son-in-law, put it crudely, "We gave them a good licking." Wellington was absolutely surprised when told they were beaten. The Whig world from which the new government sprang was one of wealth and privilege. It was all the more powerful for the intricate connections of blood which bound them together. As Lord Melbourne admitted, the Whigs did all seem to be cousins. Whigs were characterised not only by their wealth, but their great houses. Most famously, Holland House lay in Kensington, just outside the official boundaries of London. Lady Holland herself waxed eloquent on the subject of the fresh air, verdure and singing birds to be found surrounding the Jacobean dwelling after the dense vapours, gaslights and din of London. In this semi-rural but highly political paradise, guests often found it convenient to spend the night after dining, with the increased intimacy that involved. Furthermore, King William, whose visits to London houses were subject to etiquette, could dine freely at Holland House as being technically in the country. In another way, there was an outsider quality to Holland House. Years ago, the beautiful, bold Elizabeth Vassall, already the wife of another man, had captured the heart of the young Lord Holland. Divorce and remarriage followed, but not before an illegitimate son, named for his celebrated great-uncle, Charles Fox, had been born to the couple. As for Holland himself, contemporaries agreed that he was a man of rare charm, even if his fox-eyed appearance with heavy brows and weighty figure made him resemble a turbot on its tail when he wore a white tie. He was a loyal supporter of Lord Grey. Grey's cabinet, when it was formed, had as its bedrock the Whigs and the Whig cousinship. Grey had appointed, it transpired, a formidable number of his close relatives and connections. Henry Brougham took his seat on the Woolsack as Lord Chancellor. Lord Durham was Lord Privy Seal. Lord Melbourne was Home Secretary, Lord Althorpe, Chancellor of the Exchequer, as well as Leader of the Commons. In the climate of expectation, or dread, which followed the formation of the Whig government in mid-November 1830, disturbances in the country grew rather than diminished. A shabby-looking man with a pistol and a knife was found trying to get into the House of Lords with the apparent aim of assassinating Wellington. Everything for the moment hung on the future of reform. "Lambton, I wish you would take our reform bill in hand," Lord Grey, on the steps of the House of Commons, addressed his son-in-law, Lord Durham. And so a committee of four was formed: Lord Althorp, Lord John Russell, Lord Duncannon, and Durham himself. Honest Jack Althorp had made what was in effect an arranged marriage to an heiress named Esther Acklam. But then her intelligence and wit won him over. The couple had fallen in love. Esther's early death meant that Althorp resolved never to marry again. At his property at Wiseton, he built up a herd of shorthorns, which became his pride and joy, a substitute for the happy married life he no longer enjoyed. He was painted, surrounded by them, and the Morning Post would ridicule him thus: "Most rustic Althorp, honest, stupid, dull, blunderer in thoughts, thy every act a bull." But such crude lampoons missed one great quality of this man. Honest Jack was seen by one and all as trustworthy, and as such could command respect over the most difficult issues. Politics was in the blood of Lord John Russell. In 1819, at the time he was adopting the cause of parliamentary reform, he published a life of his famous radical ancestor, the Lord Russell who had been executed by Charles II for standing up for the rights of liberty against the crown. People could not help commenting on Russell's appearance. With his large head and broad shoulders, on top of a notably small body, he caused astonishment when he stood up. Yet as a character, he had not only intellectual brilliance, but extraordinary determination. The third member of the committee, Viscount Duncannon, was not a good speaker, an appalling stammer handicapping him in public so that he was nicknamed Dumb Cannon. But behind the scenes, with his calm temperament and unruffled manner, he was perfect material for a chief whip. If Russell would prove to be the crucial intelligence of the quartet, then Durham was its passionate heart. His temper made him a difficult adversary and an even trickier colleague. Durham had been fatherless since the age of 5. He would come to regard Lord Grey, whose daughter Louisa he married in 1816, as a father figure. But of course that relationship implied rebellion as well as respect. He was not known as Radical Jack for nothing. His feelings for reform were passionately expressed and unchangeable. A great deal now depended on the committee, which began to meet at Lord Durham's house in Mayfair. Meantime, an attitude of joyful expectancy pervaded all classes. The Birmingham Political Union expressed gratitude to the King for dismissing Wellington. "It is quite extraordinary how this question of reform is gaining every day," wrote Georgiana Ellis, daughter of Whig aristocrats. "It is scarcely any longer a question of whether you are for or against reform, but what sort of reform you prefer."
Adrian Scarborough was reading from Perilous Question by Antonia Fraser. The producer was Duncan Mitchell. Tomorrow there are all-night debates and simmering arguments at the same time here on BBC Radio 4. Thank you. And now on Radio 4, time for the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on today, Wednesday the 15th of May. There are warnings of gales in Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Sole, Fastnet, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at